behind. Shai shouted, "Ha!" and turned, just in time to see a man jump over the parapet behind her. She got a glimpse of him, Cantic, with eyes narrowed and his teeth showing in a black beard, a hooked blade in each hand he must have used for climbing the side of the speeding wagon, an endeavour she'd have greatly admired if he hadn't been fixed on killing her. The threat of murder surely can cramp your admiration for a body. She threw her bow at him, and he knocked it away with one arm, while he swung at her overhand with the other. She twisted to the side, and the blade thudded into the parapet. She caught his other arm as it came at her, and punched him in the ribs as she slipped around him. The wagon jolted and ditched her on her side. He twisted his curved blade, but couldn't get it free of the wood, jerked his hand out of the thong around his wrist. By then, she was up in a crouch and had her knife out, drawing little circles in the air with the point of the blade. Circles, circles, and they watched each other, both with boots planted wide and knees bent low, and the juddering wagon threatening to shake them off their feet, and the wind threatening to buffet them right over.
"Hell of a spot for a knife fight," she muttered.
The wagon bumped, and he stumbled a little, took his eye off her just long enough. She sprang at him, raising the knife like she'd stab him overhand, then whipped down low and past, slashing at his leg as she went, turning to stab him in the back, but the wagon jumped and spun her all the way round and grunting into the parapet. When she turned, he was coming at her, roaring, cutting at the wind, and her jerking back from the first slash and weaving away from the second, roof of the wagon treacherous as quicksand under her boot heels, and her eyes crossed on that blur of metal. She caught the third cut on her own blade, steel scraping on steel, and off, and leaving a cut down her left forearm, ripped sleeve flapping. They faced each other again, both breathing hard, both a little bit knifed, but nothing too much changed. Her arm sang as she squeezed her bloody fingers, but they still worked. She fainted, and a second, trying to draw him into a mistake, but he kept watching, swishing that hooked knife in front of him as if he was trying to snag a fish, the broken valley still thundering past on both sides. The wagon bounced hard, and Shai was off her feet a moment, yelping as she toppled sideways. He slashed at her and missed. She stabbed at him, and the blade just grazed his cheek. Another jolt flung them together, and he caught her wrist with his free hand, tried to stab at her, but got his knife tangled in her coat, and she grabbed his wrist, twisted it up. Not that she wanted the fucking thing, but there was no letting go of it now, their knives both waggling hopelessly at the sky, streaked with each other's blood as they staggered around the bucking roof. She kicked at his knee and made it buckle, but he had the strength, and step by wobbling step, he wrestled her to the parapet and started to bend her over it, his weight on top of her. He twisted his knife, twisting her grip loose, getting it free, both of them snarling spit at each other, wood grinding into her back and the wagon's wheels battering the ground not so far behind her head, specks of dirt stinging her cheek, his snarling face coming closer and closer and closer. She darted forwards and sank her teeth into his nose, biting, biting, her mouth salty with blood, and him roaring and twisting and pulling away, and suddenly she was right over backwards, breath whooping in, as she tumbled over the parapet, plummeted down and smashed against the side of the wagon, breath groaning out, her fallen knife pinging from the road, and somehow holding on by one clutching hand, all the fibers in her shoulder strained right to the point of tearing. She swung, wriggling around, road rushing underneath her, honking mad sounds through gritted teeth, legs milling at the air as she tried to get her other hand onto the parapet, made a grab and missed, and swung away, and the whirling wheel clipped her boot and near snatched her off. Made another grab, and got her fingertips over, worked her hand, groaning and whimpering and almost out of effort, everything numb. But she wouldn't be beaten, and she growled as she dragged herself back over. The mercenary was staggering about with an arm around his neck, Temple's face next to his, both of them grunting through bared teeth. She lunged at him, half falling, grabbed hold of his knife arm in both hands and twisted it down, both arms straining, and his jowls were trembling, torn nose oozing blood, eyes rolling towards the point of his knife as she forced it down towards him. He said something in Cantic, shaking his head, the same word over and over, but she wasn't in a mood to listen, even if she'd understood. He wheezed as the point cut through his shirt and into his chest, mouth going wide open as the blade slid further, right to the crosspiece, and she fell on top of him, blood slicking the roof of the wagon. There was something in her mouth, the tip of his nose. She spat it out and mumbled at Temple, "Who's driving?" The wagon tipped, there was a grinding jolt, and Shai was flying. Temple groaned as he rolled over to lie staring at the sky, arms out wide, the snow pleasantly cool against his bare neck. "Ah!" He sat up, wincing at a range of stabbing pains, and stared wildly about. A shallow canyon with walls of streaked stone and earth and patched snow, the road down the center, the rest strewn with boulders and choked with thorny scrub. The wagon lay on its side a dozen strides away, one door ripped off and the other hanging wide, one of the uppermost wheels gone and the other still gently turning. The tongue had sheared through and the horses were still going, no doubt delighted by their sudden liberation, already a good way down the road and dwindling into the distance. The sun was just finding its way into the bottom of the canyon, making gold glitter. A trail of treasure spilled from the back of the stricken wagon, and for 30 strides or so behind. Shai sat in the midst of it. He started running, immediately fell, and took a mouthful of snow, spat out a tiny golden coin, and floundered over. She was trying to stand, torn coat tangled in a thorn bush, and sank back down as he got there.
"My leg's fucked!"
She forced through gritted teeth, hair matted and face streaked with blood.
"Can you use it?" "No, hence fucked."
He hooked an arm around her, managed with an effort to get them both to standing, her on one good leg, him on two shaky ones.
"Got a plan yet? Kill you and hide in your body? Better than anything I've got."
He looked about the canyon sides for some means of escape, started tottering over to the most promising place, with Shai hopping beside him, both of them wheezing with pain and effort. It might almost have been comical, had he not known his erstwhile colleagues must be near. But he did know, so it wasn't.
"Sorry, I got you into this," she said. "I got myself into this, a long time ago."
He grabbed at a trailing bush, but it came free and tumbled hopelessly down in a shower of earth, most of which went straight into his mouth.
"Leave me and run," said Shai. "Tempting."
He cast about for another way up.
"But I already tried that, and it didn't work out too well."
He picked at some roots, brought down some gravel, the slope as unreliable as he'd been down the years.
"I'm trying not to make the same mistakes over and over these days." "How's that going for you?"
she grunted.
"Right now, it could be better."
The lip was only a couple of strides above his hand, but it might as well have been a mile distant. There was no...
"Hey, hey, Temple!"
A single horseman came up the road at an easy walk between the two ruts the wagon wheels had left. Everyone else was thinner than when they left Starrickland, but somehow not Braccio. He stopped not far away, leaning his bulk over his saddle horn and speaking in Styrian.
"That was quite a chase. Didn't think you had it in you."
"Captain Braccio, what a pleasure."
Temple twisted around to put himself between Shai and the mercenary. A pathetic effort at gallantry, he was almost embarrassed to have made it. He felt her take his hand, though, fingers sticky with blood, and was grateful, even if it was just to keep her balance. Some more earth slid down behind, and looking around, he saw another rider above them, loaded flatbow loose in his hands. Temple realized his knees were shaking. God, he wished he was a brave man. if only for these last few moments. Braccio nudged his horse lazily forward.
I told the old man you couldn't be trusted, but he always had a blind spot for you.
Well, good lawyers are hard to find. Temple stared around as though the means of their salvation might suddenly present themselves. They did not. He struggled to put some confidence in his creaking voice.
Take us back to Kosca, and maybe I can tidy this up. Not this time.
Braccio drew his heavy sword, steel scraping, and Shai's fingers tightened around Temple's. She might not have understood the words, but a naked blade never needs translating.
Kosca's on his way, and I think he'll want everything tidy when he gets here. That means you dead, in case you were wondering.
Yes, I'd gathered, croaked Temple.
When you drew the sword, but thanks for the explanation.
Least I could do. I like you, Temple. I always have. You're easy to like.
But you're going to kill me anyway.
You say it like there's a choice.
I blame myself, as always. Just...
Temple licked his lips and twisted his hand free of Shai's and looked Braccio in his tired eyes and tried to conjure up that earnestness.
Maybe you could let the girl go? You could do that.
Braccio frowned at Shai for a moment, who'd sunk back against the bank and was sitting silent.
I'd like to. Believe it or not, I get no pleasure from killing women.
Of course not. You wouldn't want to take a thing like that back to your daughters.
Braccio worked his shoulders uncomfortably, knives shifting across his belly, and Temple felt a crack there that he could work at. He dropped on his knees in the snow, and he clasped his hands, and he sent up a silent prayer. Not for him, but for Shai. She actually deserved saving.
It was all my idea. All me. I talked her into it. You know I'm awful that way, and she's gullible as a child, poor thing. Let her go. You'll feel better about it in the long run. Let her go. I'm begging you.
Braccio raised his brows.
That is quite moving, in fact. I was expecting you to blame her for the whole thing.
I'm somewhat moved, agreed the man with the flat bow.
We're none of us monsters.
And Braccio reached up and dabbed some tears from his leaky eye. The other one stayed dry, however.
But she tried to rob us, whoever's idea it was. And the trouble her father caused... No. Kosca wouldn't understand, and it isn't as if you'll be repaying the favour, is it?
No, muttered Temple. No, I wouldn't have thought so.
He floundered for something to say that might at least delay the inevitable, that might borrow him a few more moments, just an extra breath. Strange, it was hardly as though he was enjoying himself all that much.
Would it help if I said I was very drunk?
Braccio shook his head.
We all were.
Shitty childhood?
Mummy used to leave me in a cupboard.
Shitty adulthood?
Whose isn't?
Braccio nudged his horse forward again, its great shadow falling over Temple.
Stand up, then, eh? I'd rather get it done quick.
He worked the shoulder of his sword arm.
Neither one of us wants me hacking away at you.
Temple looked back at Shai, sitting there bloody and exhausted.
"What did he say?"
she asked. He gave a tired shrug. She gave a tired nod. It looked like even she had run out of fight. He blinked up at the sky as he got to his feet, an unremarkable greyish sky. If there was a god, he was a humourless banker, a bloodless pedant, crossing off his debts in some cosmic ledger. All take their loan, and in the end, all must repay.
Nothing personal, said Braccio.
Temple closed his eyes, the sun shining pink through the lids.
Hard not to take it personally.
I guess so.
There was a rattling sound. Temple winced. He'd always dreamed of facing death with some dignity. the way Cardia had. But dignity requires practice, and Temple had none. He couldn't stop himself cringing. He wondered how much it would hurt, having your head cut off. Did you feel it? He heard a couple of clicks and a grunt, and he cringed even more. How could you not feel it? Braccio's horse snuffled, pawing the ground, then the metallic clatter of a sword falling. Temple prized one eye open. Braccio was looking down, surprised. There was an arrow through his neck and two others in his chest. He opened his mouth and blathered blood down his shirt, then slowly tipped from the saddle and crumpled face down on the ground next to Temple's boots, one foot still tangled in its stirrup. Temple looked around. The man with the flat bow had vanished. His mount stood peacefully riderless at the top of the canyon wall.
"Here's a surprise," croaked Shai.
A horse was approaching. In the saddle, hands crossed over the horn, and the breeze stirring her short hair about her sharp-boned frown, sat Corlin.
"A pleasant one, I hope."
"Little late."
Shai took hold of Temple's limp hand and used it to drag herself wincing up.
"But I guess we'll live with the timing."
Horses appeared at the valley sides, and riders on the horses, perhaps 3 dozen of them, all well-armed and some armored. There were men and women, old and young, some faces Temple recognized from Crease, others strange to him. 3 or 4 held half-drawn bows. They weren't pointed right at Temple, but they weren't pointed far away either. Some had forearms showing, and on the forearms were tattoos. "Doom to the Union, death to the King, rise up."
"Rebels," whispered Temple.
"You always did have a talent for stating the obvious."
Corlin slid from the saddle, kicked Braccio's boot from his stirrup, and rolled his corpse over with her foot, leaving him goggling at the sky, fat face caked with dirt.
"That arm all right?"
Shai pulled her ripped sleeve back with her teeth to show a long cut, still seeping, blood streaked down to her fingertips. The sight of it made Temple's knees weak, or even weaker. It was a surprise he was still standing, all in all.
"Bit sore," she said.
Corlin pulled a roll of bandage from her pocket.
"Feels as if we've been here before, doesn't it?"
She turned her blue-blue eyes on Temple as she started to unroll it around Shai's arm. She never seemed to blink. Temple would have found that unnerving if he'd had any nerves left.
"Where's my uncle?"
"In Beacon,"
he croaked, as the rebels dismounted and began to lead their horses down the steep sides of the canyon, scattering dirt.
"Alive?"
"We don't know," said Shai. "They found out he was conscious."
"That so?"
Corlin took Temple's limp hand and clamped it around Shai's wrist.
"Hold that."
She started to unbutton her coat.
"Lam went back for him, but they ran into some trouble. That's when we took the wagon. Sweet stampeded the horses to give them some time."
Corlin shrugged off her coat and tossed it over her horse's neck, her sinewy arms blue with letters, words, slogans from shoulder to wrist.
"I'm Conthus,"
she said, pulling a knife from her belt. There was a pause.
"Oh,"
said Temple.
"Ah,"
said Shai. Corlin, or Conthus, cut the bandage with one quick movement, then pushed a pin through it. Her narrowed eyes moved towards the wreckage of the wagon, calmly taking in the gold twinkling in the snow.
"Looks like you came into some money."
Temple cleared his throat.
A little bit. Lawyer's fees have been shooting up lately."
"We could use a couple of horses."
Shai twisted her bandaged forearm free of Temple's grip and worked the fingers.
"Nicomo Kaska won't be far behind us."
"You just can't stay clear of trouble, can you?"
Corlin patted Braccio's mount on the neck.
"We have 2 spare as it goes, but it'll cost."
"Don't suppose you feel like haggling?"
"With you? I don't think so.
Let's just call it a generous contribution to the liberation of Starikland. She jerked her head at her fellows, and they hurried forward, sacks and saddlebags at the ready. One big lad nearly knocked Temple over with a shoulder in his hurry. Some started rooting on hands and knees, scooping up the gold scattered about the wreck. Others wriggled inside, and soon could be heard smashing the gratings and breaking open the boxes to steal the dragon's hoard for a third time that week. A few moments ago, Temple had been rich beyond the hopes of avarice, but since a few moments later he had been on the point of losing his head, it felt rude to complain about this outcome.
"A noble cause," he whispered. "Do help yourselves."
Times change. The mayor stood in her accustomed position at her balcony, hands at their familiar, polished places on the rail, and watched Kernsbeck's men hard at work on his new manufactory. The huge frame already towered over the amphitheatre, the new over the ancient, cobwebbed with scaffolding on the site Papa Ring's White House had once occupied. That had been a repugnant building in every sense, a building towards which for years she had directed all her hatred, cunning, and fury. And how she missed it. Never mind mayor, she had been queen of the far country when Ring stopped swinging, but no sooner had she clutched the garland of triumph than it had withered to wretched stalks. The violence and the fires drove off half the population. Whispers mounted that the gold was running dry. Then word came of a strike to the south near Hope, and suddenly people were pouring out of Crease by the hundred. With no one left to fight, she had dismissed most of her men. Disgruntled, they had dabbled in arson on their way out of town and burned down a good part of what remained. Even so, there were buildings empty and no rents coming in. Lots in town and claims in the hills that men had killed for lost all value overnight. The gaming halls and the bawdy houses were mostly boarded up, only a trickle of passing custom below her in the Church of Dice, where once she had coined money as though she ran a mint. Crease was her sole dominion, and it was next to worthless. Sometimes the mayor felt she had spent her life building things, with painstaking sweat and blood and effort, only to watch them destroyed. Through her own hubris and others' vindictiveness and the fickle thrashings of that blind thug fate, fleeing one debacle after another. Abandoning even her name in the end. Even now, she always kept a bag packed. She drained her glass and poured herself another. That's what courage is. Taking your disappointments and your failures, your guilt and your shame, all the wounds received and inflicted, and sinking them in the past. Starting again. Damning yesterday and facing tomorrow with your head held high. Times change. It's those that see it coming and plan for it and change themselves to suit that prosper. And so she had struck her deal with Kernsbeck and split her hard-won little empire again without so much as a harsh word spoken. By that time, his small manufactory, which had looked pretty damn big when he converted it from an empty brothel, was already belching black smoke from its two tin chimneys, then from three brick ones, which smogged the whole valley on a still day, and chased the few whores still plying a threadbare trade off their balconies and back indoors. By the looks of it, his new manufactory would have chimneys twice the size. The biggest building within 100 miles. She hardly even knew what the place was for, except that it had something to do with coal. The hills had hidden little gold in the end, but they were surrendering the black stuff in prodigious quantities. As the shadows of the manufactory lengthened, the mayor had started to wonder whether she might have been better off with Ring across the street. Him, at least, she had understood. But Ring was gone. And the world they had fought over was gone with him,
drifted away like smoke on the breeze. Kernsbrick was bringing men in to build and dig and stoke his furnaces. Cleaner, calmer, more sober men than Kreese was used to, but they still needed to be entertained.
Times change, eh?
She held her drink up in salute to no one. To Papa Ring, maybe. Or to herself, when she still had a name. She caught something through the distorting window of her glass and lowered it. Two riders were coming down the main street, looking as if they'd been going hard, one cradling an injured arm. It was that girl Shy South. Her and Temple, the lawyer. The mayor frowned. After 20 years dodging catastrophes, she could smell danger at 1,000 paces, and her nose was tickling something fierce as those two riders reined in at her front door. Temple slithered from his horse, fell in the mud, stumbled up, and helped down Shy, who was limping badly. The mayor drained her glass and sucked the liquor from her teeth. As she crossed her rooms, buttoning her collar tight, she glanced at the cupboard where she kept that packed bag, wondering if today would be its day. Some people are trouble. Nicomo Koska was one, Lamb was another. Then there are people who, without being troublesome in themselves, always manage to let trouble in when they open your door. Temple, she had always suspected, was one of those. Looking at him now, as she swept down the stairs, leaning against the counter in her sadly deserted gaming hall, she was sure of it. His clothes were torn and bloodied and caked in dust, his expression wild, his chest heaving.
"You look as if you've come in a hurry," she said.
He looked up, the slightest trace of guilt in his eye.
"You might say that."
"And ran into some trouble on the way."
"You might say that, too. Might I ask you for a drink?"
"Can you pay for it?"
"No.
I'm no charity."
"What are you doing here?"
He took a moment to prepare, and then produced, like a magician's trick, an expression of intense earnestness. It put her instantly on her guard.
"I have nowhere else to go."
"Are you sure you've tried hard enough?"
She narrowed her eyes. "Where's Koska?"
He swallowed.
"Funny you should ask."
"I'm not laughing."
"No."
"So it's not funny?"
"No."
He visibly abandoned earnestness and settled for simple fear.
"I would guess he's no more than a few hours behind us."
"He's coming here?"
"I expect so."
"With all his men?"
"Those that remain."
"Which is how many?"
"Some died in the mountains, a lot deserted."
"How many?"
"I would guess at least 100 still."
The mayor's nails dug at her palms as she clenched her fists.
"And the Inquisitor?"
"Very much present, as far as I'm aware."
"What do they want?"
"The Inquisitor wants to torture his way to a brighter tomorrow."
"And Koska?"
"Koska wants a fortune in ancient gold that he stole from the dragon people and that..." Temple picked nervously at his frayed collar.
"I stole from him."
"And where is this twice-stolen fortune now?" Temple grimaced.
"Stolen?
The woman Corlin took it. She turns out to be the rebel leader Conthus. It's been a day of surprises," he finished lamely.
"So it appears,"
whispered the mayor.
"Where is Corlin?"
Temple gave that helpless shrug of which he was so fond.
"In the wind?"
The mayor was less fond of that shrug.
"I have not the men to fight them," she said. "I have not the money to pay them off. I have no ancient hoard for Nicomo bloody Koska, and for damn sure no brighter tomorrow for Inquisitor fucking Lawson. Is there any chance your head will pacify them?"
Temple swallowed.
"I fear not."
"So do I. but in the absence of a better suggestion, I may have to make the offer. As it happens, Temple licked his lips, I have a suggestion. The mayor took a fistful of Temple's shirt and dragged him close. Is it a good one? Is it the best suggestion I ever heard? I profoundly doubt it, but circumstances being what they are, do you have that treaty?
I'm tired, said Corporal Bright, glancing unimpressed at the piled-up hovels of grease.
Aye,
grunted old Cog in reply. He kept having to force his eyelids up. They were that heavy from last night's revelry. Then the terror of the stampede, then a healthy trek on foot, and a hard ride to follow.
And dirty, said Bright.
Aye. The smoke of last night's fires, and the rolling through the brush running from stomping horses, then the steady showering of dirt from the hooves of the galloping mounts in front.
And sore, said Bright. No doubt.
Last night's revelry again, and the riding again, and Cog's arm still sore from the fall in the mountains, and the old wound in his arse always aching. You wouldn't think an arrow in the arse would curse you all your days, but there it is. Arse armor. That was the key to the mercenary life.
It's been a testing campaign, said Cog.
If you can apply the word to half a year's hard riding, hard drinking, killing and theft.
What else would you apply it to?
Bright considered that a moment.
True. Have you seen a worse, though? You've been with Koska for years.
The north was colder. Kadir was dustier. That last Styrian mess was bloodier. Full-on revolt and the company at one point.
He shifted the manacles at his belt.
Gave up on using chains and had to go with hangings for every infraction. But all considered, no, I ain't seen a worse.
Cog sniffed up some snot, worked it thoughtfully about his mouth, gathering a good sense of its consistency, then leaned back and spat it arcing through a hovel's open window.
Never saw a man could spit like you, said Bright.
It's all about putting the practice in, said Cog. Like anything else.
Keep moving!
Roared Koska over his shoulder, up at the head of the column. If you could call 18 men a column. Still, they were the lucky ones. The rest of the company were most likely still slogging across the plateau on foot, the ones that were still alive, anyway. Bright's thoughts were evidently marching in the same direction.
Lost a lot of good men these last few weeks.
Bird might be stretching it.
You know what I mean. Can't believe Braccio's gone.
He's a loss.
And Joubert?
Can't say I'm sorry that black bastard's head ain't attached no more.
He was a strange one, right enough, but a good ally in a tough corner.
I'd rather stay out of the tough corners.
Bright looked sideways at him, then dropped his horse back a stretch, so the others up front wouldn't mark him.
Couldn't agree more. I want to go home, is what I'm saying.
Where's home to men like us?
I want to go anywhere but here, then.
Cog glanced about at the tangled mass of wood and ruins that was Crease, never a place to delight a cultured fellow, and less so than ever now, by the looks of things. Parts of it burned out, and a lot of the rest near deserted. Those left looked like the ones who couldn't find a way to leave, or were too far gone to try. A beggar of truly surpassing wretchedness hobbled after them for a few strides with his hand out before falling in the gutter. On the other side of the street, a toothless old woman laughed and laughed and laughed. Mad, or heard something real funny. Mad seemed likelier.
I take your point, said Cog. But we've got that money to find.
Even though he weren't entirely sure he wanted to find it. All his life he'd been clutching at every copper he could get his warty fingers around. Then, suddenly, he had so much gold, none of it seemed worth anything any more. So much The world seemed to make no sense in the light of it.
Then you keep a little back?
Course, a little.
More than a little, in fact. The pouch under his armpit was heavy with coins. Not so much it made him sweat, but a tidy haul.
We all did, muttered Bright. So it's Koska's money we're after, really, ain't it?
Cog frowned.
There's the principal and all.
Principal? Really?
Can't let folks just up and rob you.
We robbed it ourselves, didn't we?
Said Bright, an assertion Cog could by no means deny.
I'm telling you, it's cursed. From the moment we laid our hands on it, things have gone from shit to shitter.
No such thing as curses.
Tell it to Braccio and Joubert. How many of us set off from Starrickland?
We're in 400, according to Friendly, and Friendly don't get a count wrong.
How many now?
Cog opened his mouth, then closed it. The point was obvious to all.
Exactly, said Bright. Hang around out here much longer, we'll be down to none.
Cog sniffed and grunted and spat again, right into a first-floor window this time around. An artist has to challenge himself after all.
Been with Koska a long time.
Times change. Look at this place.
Bright nodded towards the vacant hovels that a month or two before had boiled over with humanity.
What's that stink, anyway?
Cog wrinkled his nose. The place had always stunk, of course, but that healthy, heartening stench of shit and low living that had always smelled like home to him. There was an acrid sort of a flavour on the air now, a pall of brownish smoke hanging over everything.
Dunno. Can't say I care for it one bit.
I want to go home, said Bright miserably.
The column was coming to the centre of town now, insofar as the place had one. They were building something on one side of the muddy street, teetering scaffold and lumber stacked high. On the other side, the Church of Dice still stood, where Cog had spent several very pleasant evenings a month or two before. Koska held up his fist for a halt in front of it, and with the help of Sergeant Friendly, disentangled himself from the saddle and clambered stiffly down. The mayor stood waiting on the steps in a black dress buttoned to the neck. What a woman that was. A lady, Cog would almost have said, dusting the word off in the deepest recesses of his memory.
General Koska, she said, smiling warmly.
I did not think...
Don't pretend you're surprised,
he snapped.
But I am. You come at a rather inopportune time. We are expecting...
Where is my gold?
I'm sorry?
By all means, play the wide-eyed innocent, but we both know better. Where is my damned notary, then?
Inside, but... The old man shouldered past her and limped grumbling up the steps, Friendly, Swarbrick, and Captain Dimbick following.
The mayor caught Lawson's arm with a gentle hand.
Inquisitor Lawson, I must protest.
He frowned back.
My dear Lady Mayor, I've been protesting for months. Much good it has done me.
Koska had seemed heedless of the half-dozen frowning thugs lounging on either side of the door, but Cog noted them well enough as he climbed the steps after the others, and from the worried look on Bright's face, he did too. Might be that the company had the numbers and more coming across the plateau as fast as they could walk, but Cog didn't fancy fighting right then and there. He didn't fancy fighting one bit.
Captain Dimbick straightened his uniform. Even if the front was crusted with dirt, even if it was coming apart at the seams, even if he no longer even belonged to any army, had no nation, fought for no cause or principle a sane man could believe in, even if he was utterly lost and desperately concealing a bottomless hatred and pity for himself, even then, better straight than crooked. The place had changed since last he visited. The gaming hall had been largely cleared to leave an expanse of creaking boards, the dice and card tables shifted against the walls, the women ushered away, the clients vanished. Only 10 or so of the mayor's thugs remained, noticeably armed and scattered watchfully about under the empty alcoves in the walls, a man wiping glasses behind the long counter, and in the centre of the floor a single table, recently polished, but still showing the stains of hard use. Temple sat there before a sheaf of papers, peculiarly unconcerned, as he watched Dimbic's men tramp in to surround him. Could you even call them men? Ragged and haggard beyond belief, and their morale, never the highest, ebbed to a sucking nadir. Not that they had ever been such very promising examples of humanity. Dimbic had tried, once upon a time, to impose some discipline upon them, after his discharge from the army, after his disgrace. He remembered dimly, as if seen through a room full of steam, that first day in uniform, so handsome in the mirror, puffed up on stories of derring do, a bright career at his fingertips. He miserably straightened the greasy remnants again. How could he have sunk so low? Not even scum, lackey to scum. He watched the infamous Nikomo Koska pace across the empty floor, bent spurs jingling, his eyes fixed upon Temple, and his rat-like face locked in an expression of vengeful hatred. To the counter he went, of course, where else? He took up a bottle, spat out its cork, and swallowed a good quarter of the contents in one draught.
"So, here he is," grated the old man. "The cuckoo in the nest, the serpent in the bosom, the
maggot in the shit," suggested Temple.
"Why not, since you mention it? What did Vecurio say? Never fear your enemies, but your friends always. A wiser man than I, no doubt. I forgave you, and how am I repaid? I hope you're taking notes, Warbrick. You can prepare a little parable, perhaps, on the myth of redemption and the price of betrayal."
The author scrambled to produce his pencil as Koska's grim smile faded to leave him simply grim.
"Where is my gold, Temple?"
"I don't have it." The notary held up his sheaf of papers. "But I do have this."
"It better be valuable,"
snapped Koska, taking another swallow. Sergeant Friendly had wandered to one of the dice tables and was sorting dice into piles, apparently oblivious to the escalating tension. Inquisitor Lawson gave Dimbic a curt nod as he entered. Dimbic respectfully returned it, licked a finger, and slicked his front hairs into position, wondering if the Inquisitor had been serious about securing him a new commission in the King's Own when they returned to Adua. Most likely not, but we all need pretty dreams to cling to. The hope of a second chance, if not the chance itself.
"It is a treaty,"
Temple spoke loudly enough for the whole room to hear,
"bringing Kreese and the surrounding country into the Empire. I suspect His Radiance the Emperor will be less than delighted to find an armed party sponsored by the Union has encroached upon his territory."
"I'll give you an encroachment you won't soon forget."
Koska let his left hand rest on the hilt of his sword.
"Where the hell is my gold?"
With a draining inevitability, the atmosphere ratcheted towards bloodshed. Coats were flicked open, itchy fingers crept to ready grips, blades were loosened in sheaths, eyes were narrowed. Two of Dimbic's men eased the wedges from the triggers of their loaded flatbows. The glasswiper had put a surreptitious hand on something beneath the counter, and Dimbic did not doubt it would have a point on the end. He watched all this with a helpless sense of mounting horror. He hated violence. It was the uniforms he'd become a soldier for. The epaulets, and the marching, and the bands.
"Wait!"
snapped Lawson, striding across the room. Dimbic was relieved to see that someone in authority still had a grip on their reason.
"Superior Pike said most clearly there were to be no imperial entanglements."
He snatched the treaty from Temple's hand.
"This expedition has been enough of a disaster without us starting a war."
"You cannot mean to dignify this charade,"
sneered Koska.
"He lies for a living."
"Not this time.
The mayor glided into the room with another pair of her men, one of whom had lost an eye, but in so doing gained considerably in menace. That document is endorsed by elected representatives of the townspeople of Crease, and is fully binding.
I consider it my best work.
If he was lying, Temple was even more smug about it than usual.
It makes use of the principle of inviolate ownership enshrined at the formation of the Union, refers back to the earliest imperial claim on the territory, and is even fully binding under mining law. I feel confident you will find it incontestable in any court.
Alas, my lawyer departed my service under something of a cloud,
forced Kosker through gritted teeth.
If we contest your treaty, it will have to be in the court of sharp edges.
Lawson snorted.
It's not even signed,
and he tossed the document flapping onto the table. Kosker narrowed his bloodshot eyes.
What if it were? You, of all people, should know, Temple, that the only laws that matter are those backed by force. The nearest imperial troops are weeks away.
Temple's smile only widened.
Oh, they're a little closer than that.
The doors were suddenly flung wide, and, under the disbelieving eyes of the heavily armed assembly, soldiers tramped into the Church of Dice. Imperial troops, in gilded greaves and breastplates, with broad-bladed spears in their fists and short-bladed swords at their hips, with round shields marked with the hand of Juvens and the five thunderbolts and the sheaf of wheat, and all looking as if they had marched straight from antiquity itself.
What the shit?
Muttered Kosker. In the center of this bizarre honor guard strode an old man, his short beard white as snow, his gilded helm adorned with a tall plume. He walked slowly, deliberately, as though it caused him pain, yet perfectly erect. He looked neither to the left nor to the right, as if Kosker and his men, the mayor and her men, Temple and Lawson and everyone else, were all insects, utterly beneath his notice. As if he were a god, obliged for this moment to walk among the filth of humanity. The mercenaries edged nervously away, repelled not so much by fear of the Emperor's legions as by this old man's aura of untouchable command. The mayor prostrated herself at his feet in a rustling of skirts.
Legat Samus, she breathed. Your Excellency, we are inexpressibly honored by your presence.
Dimbik's jaw dropped. Legat Samus, who had crushed the Emperor's enemies at the Third Battle of Damium and ordered every prisoner put to death, who, across the circle of the world, was famous for his military brilliance and infamous for his ruthlessness, who they had all supposed was many hundreds of miles away to the south, standing before them now in the flesh. Dimbik somehow felt he had seen that magnificent face before somewhere, on a coin, perhaps.
You are honored, pronounced the old man. For my presence is the presence of His Radiance, the Emperor, Galtus the First.
The legate's body might have been withered by age, but his voice, seasoned with the slightest imperial accent, was that of a colossus, booming from the lofty rafters, as awe-inspiring as deep thunder close at hand. Dimbik's knees, always weakened by authority, positively itched to bend.
Where is the instrument?
Intoned the legate. The mayor rose and abjectly indicated the table on which Temple had arranged pen and document. Samus grunted as he stiffly leaned over it.
I sign with the name Galtus, for this hand is the hand of the Emperor.
With a flourish that would have been outrageous under any other circumstances, he signed.
And so it is done. You stand now upon imperial soil, and are imperial subjects under the protection of His Radiance, warmed by His bounty, humbled beneath His law.
The ringing echoes faded, and he frowned, as though he had only just become aware of the mercenaries. His merciless gaze swept over them, and Dimbik felt a chill to his very core. Samus formed his words with fearsome precision. Who are these people? Even Koska had been silenced by the theatre of the moment, but now, much to everyone's dismay, he found his voice again. It sounded cracked, weak, almost ridiculous after the legates, but he found it, nonetheless, waving his half-emptied bottle for added emphasis.
I am Nicomo Koska, Captain General of the Company of the Gracious Hand, and...
And we were just leaving,
snapped Lawson, seizing Koska's elbow. The old man refused to be moved.
Without my gold? I hardly think so.
Dimbik did not care in the least for the way things were going. Probably no one did. There was a gentle rattle as Friendly threw his dice. The mayor's one-eyed thug suddenly had a knife in his hand. That did not strike him as a positive development.
Enough!
Hissed Lawson, halfway now to wrestling the old man by his armpit.
When we reach Starrickland, every man will get a bonus. Every man!
Swarbrick was crouching against the counter, apparently trying to vanish into the floor, while madly scribbling in his notebook. Sergeant Cog was edging towards the doorway, and he had good instincts. The odds had changed, and not for the better. Dimbik had begged Koska to wait for more men, the old fool, but he might as well have argued with the tide. And now all it would take was a loose trigger, and there would be a bloodbath. Dimbik held one hand up to the flat bowman as to a skittish horse.
Easy.
I shit on your bonus,
snarled Koska, struggling with scant dignity to shake Lawson off.
Where's my fucking gold?
The mayor was backing away, one pale hand against her chest, but Samus only appeared to grow in stature, his white brows drawing inwards.
What is this impertinence?
I can only apologize, blathered Temple.
Samus struck him across the face with the back of his hand and knocked him to the floor.
Kneel when you address me.
Dimbik's mouth was dry, the pulse pounding in his head. That he would have to die for Koska's absurd ambition seemed horribly unfair. His sash had already given its life for the dubious cause, and that seemed more than sacrifice enough. Dimbik had once been told that the best soldiers are rarely courageous. That was when he had been sure it was the career for him. He started to slide one hand towards his sword, far from sure what he would do with it once he reached the hilt.
I will not be disappointed again!
Shrieked the old man, struggling to reach his own hilt, with Lawson restraining him and a half-full bottle still clutched in his other fist.
Men of the Gracious Hand, draw your...
No!
Lawson's voice barked out like a slamming door.
Captain General Dimbik, take the traitor Nicomo Koska under arrest.
There was the very slightest pause, probably no more than a breath, for all it felt far longer, while everyone assessed the odds and the outcomes, while everyone judged just where the shifting power sat, while everything dropped into place in Dimbik's mind, and no doubt the minds of every other person present. Just a breath, and everything was rearranged.
"Of course, Inquisitor," said Dimbik.
The two flat bowmen raised their weapons to point them at Koska. They looked slightly surprised that they were doing it, but they did it nonetheless. Friendly looked up from his dice and frowned slightly.
"Two,"
he said. Koska gazed slack-jawed at Dimbik.
"So, that's how it is."
The bottle dropped from his nerveless fingers, clattered to the floor, and rolled away, dribbling liquor.
That's how it is it?
How else would it be?
Said Dimbik.
Sergeant Cog?
That venerable soldier stepped forward, for once with an impressive degree of military snap.
Sir?
Please disarm Master Koska, Master Friendly, and Master Swarbrick.
Place them in irons for the trip, said Lawson. They will face trial on our return.
Why me?
Squeaked Swarbrick, eyes wide as saucers.
Why not you?
Corporal Bright looked the author over, and finding no weapon, he jerked the pencil from his hand, tossed it on the floor, and made great show of grinding it under his heel.
"Prisoner," muttered Friendly.
For some reason he had the faintest smile on his face as the manacles were snapped around his wrists.
"I'll be back!"
snarled the old man, spraying spit over his shoulder as Cog dragged him wriggling away, empty scabbard flapping.
"Laugh while you can, because Nicomo Koska always laughs last. I'll be revenged on the whole pack of you. I will not be disappointed again. I will—"
The door swung shut upon him.
"Who was that drunkard?" asked Samus.
"Nicomo Koska, Your Excellency," muttered Temple, still on his knees and with one hand pressed to his bloody mouth. "Infamous soldier of fortune."
The legate grunted.
"Never heard of him."
Lawson placed one hand upon his breast and bowed low.
"Your Excellency, I pray that you accept my apologies for any and all inconveniences, trespasses, and—"
"You have 8 weeks to leave Imperial territory," said Samus. "Any of you found within our borders after that time will be buried alive."
He slapped dust from his breastplate.
"Have you such a thing as a bath?"
"Of course, Your Excellency," murmured the mayor, virtually groveling. "We will do the very best we can."
She turned her eyes to Dimbik as she ushered the legate towards the stairs.
"Get out," she hissed.
The brand new Captain General was by no means reluctant to oblige. With the greatest of relief, he and his men spilled into the street and prepared their tired mounts for the trip out of town. Koska had been manhandled into his saddle, sparse hair in disarray, gazing down at Dimbik with a look of stunned upset.
"I remember when I took you on," he muttered. "Drunk and spurned and worthless. I graciously offering my hand."
He attempted to mime the offering of his hand, but was prevented by his manacles. Dimbik smoothed down his hair.
"Times change."
"Here is justice, Icewarbrick. Here is loyalty. Take a good look, all of you. This is where charity gets you. The fruits of polite behavior and thought for your fellow man."
"For pity's sake, someone shut him up," snapped Lawson, and Cog leaned from his saddle and stuffed a pair of socks in Koska's mouth.
Dimbik leaned closer to the Inquisitor.
"It might be best if we were to kill them. Koska still has friends among the rest of the company, and—"
"A point well made and well taken, but no. Look at him."
The infamous mercenary did indeed present a most miserable picture, sitting hunched on horseback, with hands manacled behind him, his torn and muddied cloak all askew, the gilt on his breastplate all peeling and rust showing beneath, his wrinkled skin blotchy with rash, one of Cog's socks dangling from his mouth.
"Yesterday's man, if ever there was one. And in any case, my dear Captain General—"
Dimbik stood tall and straightened his uniform at the title. He very much enjoyed the ring of it.
"We need someone to blame."
In spite of the profound pain in his stomach, the ache in his legs, the sweat spreading steadily under his armor, he remained resplendently erect upon the balcony, rigid as a mighty oak, until long after the mercenaries had filed away into the haze. Would the great legate Samus, ruthless commander, undefeated general, right hand of the emperor, feared throughout the circle of the world, have allowed himself to display the least trace of weakness after all? It felt an age of agony before the mayor stepped out onto the balcony with Temple behind her and spoke the longed-for words.
"They're gone."
Every part of him sagged, and he gave a groan from the very bottom of his being. He removed that ridiculous helmet, wiping the sweat from his forehead with a trembling hand. He could scarcely recall having donned a more absurd costume in all his many years in the theatre. No garlands of flowers flung by an adoring audience, perhaps, as had littered the broad stage of Adua's house of drama after his every appearance as the first of the Magi, but his satisfaction was no less complete.
"I told you I had one more great performance in me," said Lestek.
"And so you did," said the mayor.
"You both provide